Lecture 26, Otello, Conclusion, Falstaff.
We return to the life and operas of Verdi. This is Lecture 26, entitled Otello, Conclusion, and Falstaff. Sometime during the end of November of 1884, the 71-year-old Giuseppe Verdi joined Giuseppina at their winter place at the Palazzo Doria Pamphili in Genoa. And just like that, after having stared at Arrigo Boito's libretto for Otello for 5 years, after having written, a note here, a note there, after having thought about whether or not he should compose again way too much for way too long, the flame finally ignited. We mean really ignited. And there in Genoa, Verdi began to compose Otello easily and naturally, if not terribly quickly. After all of Verdi's questions and doubts about his own creative powers came as a terrific relief for him, Verdi immediately wrote Boito, and we quote, "It seems impossible, yet it is true. I am busy and I am writing. I am writing because I am writing without a goal, without worries, without thinking of afterward," unquote. Now, what Verdi was referring to by afterward was all the stuff he hated, like proofreading and hiring singers and rehearsing and the inevitable and necessary publicity, all the stuff that was part and parcel of an operatic production. So Verdi wasn't thinking about afterwards. He wasn't thinking about the stuff. He was just composing for the pure joy of it, enjoying the process. We can only wish, for his sake, that Verdi had allowed himself to enjoy the process, the actual making of music, a bit more throughout his long and marvelous career. But then, this sort of self-knowledge and freedom from pressure often doesn't come, if it comes at all, until older age. When word got out that Verdi was truly finally composing Otello, the musical world beat a most unwelcome path to his door. The conductor, Enrico Faccio, had told Verdi that he had to finish the opera, quote, "for the glory of Italian art," unquote, which was just the sort of Butinsky comment that generally drove Verdi nuts. Impresarios from Europe and America begged Verdi for the right to premiere the new opera, and producers, singers, and publishers virtually laid siege to Verdi's home in Genoa, each hoping to get a piece of the action, hoping to be part of what appeared almost certainly to be Verdi's last opera. If they were smart, my friends, they packed their bags and went home, because nothing was going to happen quickly with Otello. The Verdi, who used to write and produce an opera in the span of 3 months, was a man of the past. 1884 ended, 1885 came and went, 1886 began, and Verdi was still composing, telling anyone who'd listen that he still wasn't sure if he'd ever be able to finish. In January of 1886, Verdi officially renamed the opera Otello, something that he'd been advised against doing because of the comparisons that would inevitably be drawn between Rossini's Otello and his own Otello. Verdi explained his reasons for naming the opera Otello to Boito, and we quote Verdi, "It is Otello who acts, loves, is jealous, kills, and kills himself. It seems hypocritical not to call it Otello. I would rather people say he wanted to fight with the giant Rossini and was crushed, then he wanted to hide behind the name Iago," unquote. On November 1st of 1886, over 7 years after that famous dinner party in Milan, Verdi wrote a note to Boito, and we quote, "È finito. It is finished. Here's to our health and to his Otello's as well," unquote. Boito's response, "The great dream has become a reality." Fittingly, the Teatro La Scala in Milan was chosen for the premiere of Otello. Verdi was guaranteed total, absolute control over every aspect of the production, from the selection of the singers to the design of the poster, on which Verdi insisted that both his name and Boito's name appear and would indicate no date for the premiere. He also had authority over set design, costume design, even the lighting. You know, we've had no time whatsoever to talk about staging and lighting over the course of these lectures. A necessary but unfortunate sacrifice to the restrictions imposed by the brevity of our time together. During the course of Verdi's own long career, the nature of stage lighting, and therefore the nature of the illusions that could be created on stage, changed profoundly. Verdi's earliest operas, like Nabucco, were lit by candlelight, which, in general, required that singers be relatively stationary on stage while they were singing, and powerfully affected the nature of set design. By Verdi's middle period, Aida, for example, most theaters were being lit by gas, which allowed much greater flexibility in terms of both the intensity and amount of light that can be thrown on different parts of the stage at any given moment. Otello was Verdi's first opera to be lit by electric lights, and these, of course, revolutionized the opera stage. The flexibility and variability of electric lighting, the way in which one part of the stage could be lit while other parts remained in darkness, the ease with which intensity, location, and color could be changed, well, electric lights altered forever the operatic experience. With electric lights and spotlights, singers could move more easily and naturally around the stage, and their faces could be seen much more clearly by the audience. As a consequence, singers increasingly had to be able to act, really be able to act, not just sing. And in this new age of electricity, more than a few careers went by the wayside because certain singers couldn't really act. Just as the invention of the talking picture, talkies, or talking movies, 40 years later, ended acting careers when it was discovered that certain actors couldn't talk. Anyway, Verdi had total and absolute control over the premiere production of Otello, including the right to cancel the entire production after the final dress rehearsal if he so chose. All rehearsals were to be closed to outsiders, and no overt publicity was to be undertaken to promote the opera before its premiere. These were just some of Verdi's conditions, and of course, La Scala accepted them unconditionally. We search for events in our world today that parallel those of the premiere of Verdi's Otello on February 5th, 1887, and I would tell you up front, we search in vain. Certainly, the gala star-studded opening of a long-awaited and highly anticipated movie can be a big deal. The week prior to the Super Bowl or the World Series can be a big deal. The victory parade afforded a championship team by a grateful hometown, or in the case of an Olympic or World Cup champion, by a grateful and proud nation, can be, in terms of numbers of people and civic joy, an even bigger deal. But in both of these examples, movies and sports, the event being celebrated is the accomplishment of a team of people, certainly not that usually of an individual, and neither of them constitutes, with apologies to our favorite popular movies, high art. So we search vainly for parallels to the hoopla and joy and pride that surrounded the premiere of Verdi's Otello on February 5th of 1887. We are told that, quote, "A great artistic event like Otello was seen in Italy as an occasion for national patriotic celebration, with Verdi treated like a hero returning to home soil after a major victory. The mayor of Milan ordered all the streets and squares around La Scala closed to traffic on February 5th, the morning of the premiere. The crowds flooding the area made the Via Manzoni impassable even before dawn. Around noon, it was rumored that Francesco Tamagno, who was to premiere the role of Otello, had taken ill. A doctor was sent to his hotel. Word went around at 4 in the afternoon that his wig would not fit and that another had to be sent for. Every window and balcony within blocks of La Scala was filled with people. Bright tapestries and cloths of gold and scarlet damask hung from windows nearby. In spite of the bitter cold, many windows were open, and the crowds kept shouting, Viva Verdi! Viva Verdi! All along the Via Manzoni, from the Grand Hotel de Milan to the theater. The world premiere of Otello was one of the most important productions in the history of opera. Verdi's first new work since Aida in 1871 marked an apotheosis for its creator, who had been dignified a week before, on January 27th, by King Umberto I, who decorated him with the Great Cross of the Order of Saints Maurizio and Lazzaro. unquote. 3 days later, on January 30th, Verdi sent the Minister of the Interior a telegram of thanks for this decoration. You know, for someone not intimately familiar with Verdi and his personality, the telegram seems to fairly ooze with the necessary and expected obsequiousness and gratitude. For those of us who do know Verdi, there is an undertone of sarcasm that is unmistakably his own. We quote that letter from Verdi. "I am deeply grateful that His Majesty our King has deigned to remember my poor name. The honor that he wished to bestow on me is a great compensation for that little I have been able to accomplish in my long, now too long, artistic career. This high honor will be a precious memory for me in the years that are still left to me to live in the stillness of my village," unquote. As curtain time approached, Boito and Giuseppina took their seats next to each other in their box. Verdi, typical to form, remained backstage where he could pace and twitch like an expected father to his heart's content. The ovations began in the first act. The chorus, Fuoco di Gioia, had to be encored. After the first act, the audience demanded that Verdi take the first of his many curtain calls. An eyewitness, Gino Monaldi, recalled that when Verdi came out on stage, quote, "an immense shout makes the theater literally rock. Verdi bends his head slightly and smiles, the frantic enthusiasm of the huge gathering bringing tears to his eyes," unquote. The applause and cries of Bravo and Viva Verdi grew and grew as the opera progressed. In the fourth act, Desdemona's Willow Song had to be encored, and we will hear the Willow Song in just a few moments. And when the curtain came down, after a brief moment of silence, pandemonium let loose. Dozens of curtain calls ensued, and Verdi asked Boito to come down from his box and onto the stage, where he drew him by the hand out before the audience. Boito later said that it was a gesture he would never forget. Just as Verdi, to his dying day, said that Otello was as much Boito's baby as it was his own. What happened when Verdi left La Scala that night is best quoted from the literature. It seems so incredible that you might not believe me if I tell you in my own words. According to Mary Jane Phillips Matz, and we quote, "When Verdi, Giuseppina, and Boito left the theater, the mob at the stage door nearly tore Verdi's clothes off. His carriage had moved only a few feet when the crowd began to shout, 'Take away the horses! Take away the horses!' and unharness the team. More than a dozen men tried to lift the carriage onto their shoulders. Finally, it was drawn to the Grand Hotel de Milan by manpower." Verdi, Boito said, was pale with emotion. At the entrance to the hotel, the three tried to get out of the carriage, but could not. Verdi then managed to leave the carriage alone, entrusting Giuseppina to Boito. As he fought to reach the door of the hotel, the crowd, which Boito described as insane, surrounded him. Eventually, Verdi, his librettist, and his singers came out onto the balcony facing the Via Manzoni, where they were greeted with waves of applause and shouting. Music was played under his windows until 5 o'clock in the morning. Unquote. As usual, it was Giuseppina who truly understood the significance of the demonstration offered to her husband. Describing that evening, she wrote to Marietta Calvi Carrera that the ovation for Verdi was, and we quote Giuseppina, "deafening and reached the point of delirium. But I confess to you that I was moved by it because this admiration, this passionate demonstration, comes from a high esteem, an affection that is heavy with understanding, that has never been denied by anyone during all of Verdi's long career. In Milan, he gave the first proofs of his immense gift, and he wanted to give Milan the last fruit of his genius. Verdi's genius is inextricably tied to the resurrection of Italy." Unquote. Having arrived, safely, thank goodness, and still fully dressed, back at his hotel room, Verdi was surrounded by his inner circle, Giuseppina, Boito, Teresa Stoltz, Tito Ricordi, Franco Faccio, and the tenor Francesco Tamagno, who had just sung the role of Otello. It would have been nice, my friends, if Verdi could have enjoyed this capstone moment, this climactic moment of his career, but he could not. If he were 30 years younger, we've little doubt that Verdi would have partied hardy long into the night. but he was going on 74 years of age. He didn't expect to ever compose another opera, and the magnificence of Otello's reception had taken on, for him, a valedictory air, a most unwelcome sense of finality, that his long ride, his long career, was over. 11 months after the premiere, Verdi wrote Franco Faccio and described what happened as he left the theater, and we quote Verdi. "That first night, as I was leaving the theater in the midst of the affectionate good wishes on stage, I met on the staircase the orchestra players who, deeply moved by everything that had happened that night, without saying a word, grasped my hand one after the other, and on their faces were written these words, 'Maestro, we will never see each other again here. Never again.'" Never again. It's a phrase that tolls like a bell for the dead, unquote. So there in his hotel suite, surrounded by his family and friends, Verdi suddenly and understandably became depressed, melancholy, as his friends described it, to the point of tears. According to an unnamed reporter who was there, quote, "He said he felt as though he'd fired his last cartridge. We tried to talk him out of it, but the old man shook his head sadly and said, 'Oh, glory, glory, I so loved my solitude in the company of Otello and Desdemona. Now the crowd, always greedy for something new, has taken them away from me.' And then he said something that raised our spirits and moved Boito to tears. 'My friends, if I were 30 years younger, I should like to begin a new opera tomorrow, providing that Boito wrote the libretto.'" Unquote. Verdi's sense of regret and melancholy in the face of what he perceived at that moment as the end mirrors almost exactly that of Desdemona when she sings her miraculous Willow Song in Act 4 of Otello. We set the scene. The evil Iago has successfully convinced the Moorish slave turned Venetian general Otello that Otello's beautiful young wife, Desdemona, is having an affair with his lieutenant, the dashing young aristocratic Cassio. Of course, it's all a terrible lie, but Otello's sensitivities as being an outsider, a stranger in a strange land, have made him particularly susceptible to Iago's brand of calumny. So Otello, believing the worst, has told Desdemona to make her peace with her god, and Desdemona has retired to her suite, terrified, confused, aged beyond her years, and saddened beyond description. If Iago is the personification of evil, then Desdemona is the personification of good, a genuinely Christ-like figure who now realizes that only through the sacrifice of her own life can she restore the sanity of her husband. So she accepts the seeming necessity of her own death as she sits there, attended only by her lady's maid, Amelia, frightened and profoundly unhappy. How did Shakespeare and then Boito handle this excruciatingly private and painful moment? The best way possible, peripherally from the side. Desdemona sings a song that was sung to her by her own nurse, a song about a peasant girl, a song about love lost and death, called the Willow Song. And here's where Verdi steps in and renders the profound utterly sublime. Sublime because it's Verdi's musical setting of the words that transforms, elevates, intensifies, and crystallizes the emotional impact of those words 100-fold, 1,000-fold. More than words ever can by themselves, Verdi's music projects the complex state of grief, confusion, pain, and self-sacrifice that Desdemona is feeling at this moment. We might hear her words in our ears, but we feel her agony through Verdi's music in our hearts. Sitting before her dressing table mirror, Desdemona, in a weary monotone, tells her maid Emilia, "My mother had a poor maid. She was pretty and in love. Her name was Barbara. She was in love with a man who abandoned her. She used to sing a song, the Willow Song. Undo my hair. I cannot get that song out of my mind." A brief woodwind introduction sets a quiet, melancholy, and somewhat rustic mood. Verse one then begins, in which every single ounce of Verdi's amazing lyric art is on display. The quiet, forlorn accompaniment reinforces the intensely intimate and introspective character of this music. Desdemona is ostensibly singing to Emilia as she tells her the story of this Barbara, but in reality, of course, she's singing to herself as she does everything in her power to come to grips with her sadness and her fear. Desdemona sings, "Singing, she wept on the lonely heath, the poor soul wept. O salce, 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 O willow, willow, willow. She sat, her head bent on her breast. Willow, 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 come sing, come sing. The weeping willow shall be my funeral garland." Desdemona turns to Emilia, who is brushing her hair, and sings, "Affrettate, fra poco giunge Otello. Hurry, Otello will be here soon." Let's listen up to this point, starting with Desdemona's words, "Piangia cantando," singing, she wept. Otello, Willow Song. Desdemona resumes with the second verse of her song. Rushing strings at once illustrate the brook and the bitter wave of tears evoked in the following text as she sings, "The brook flowed between flowery banks, her broken heart lamented, and from her eyes flowed a bitter wave of tears. Willow, 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 come sing, come sing. The weeping willow shall be my funeral garland." The birds came flying from dark branches down towards her sweet song. So pitiful was her weeping that the very stones melted. At this point, Desdemona takes a ring from her finger and again turns to Emilia and sings, "Put this ring away. Poor Barbara, I think her song used to end this way. He was born for glory, and I was born to love." Now, at this point, my friends, a noise is heard, and Desdemona's fear, which she has hidden so very well, suddenly leaps to the surface. Panicked, she sings, "Listen, I hear someone wailing. Be quiet. Someone's knocking at the door." But Emilia gently shakes her head and sings, "È il vento. It's only the wind." Desdemona calms down and finishes her song. "I to love him and then to die. Cantiamo, cantiamo. Come sing, salce, willow, willow, willow." The song over, Desdemona fights to keep her composure as she sings, "Emilia, farewell. How my eyes burn. It bodes weeping. Buona notte. good night. Deep funereal tolling in the orchestra accompanies the words, Buona notte. Death is palpably present, and Desdemona knows it. Suddenly, she loses her composure entirely, and with the greatest passion, as Emilia begins to leave, Desdemona sings, Ah, Emilia, Emilia, addio, farewell. Theirs is a final farewell, and they both know it. They embrace, and then Emilia exits. A long descending orchestral postlude reinforces the mood of impending doom. We listen to the heartbreaking remainder of the Willow Song, beginning with the rushing strings that introduce the second verse and Desdemona's words, Scoriano i rivi, the brook flowed between flowery banks.
Thank you.
post-Otello depression and unhappiness. Verdi's melancholia continued in the months and years after the premiere of Otello in 1887. It's not that he wasn't busy. He was as busy as ever, overseeing performances of Otello across Europe, working on his farm, corresponding with his friends. And it's not as if he wasn't doing anything worthwhile either. Verdi's philanthropy in these years was incredible. Honestly, there's no other word for it. He underwrote and oversaw the construction of the Villanova Hospital in the nearby city of Villanova, which opened its doors on November 5, 1888, and which operates to this day with 40 beds. Plans were also in the works for Verdi to build a rest home for sick and disabled singers and musicians to be called the Casa de Riposo, the House of Rest. And, as they had for decades, Verdi and Giuseppina continued to contribute generously to relief efforts for victims of floods and fires and continued to help the local poor with gifts of money, food, clothing, school books, even coffins when the need arose. And what Giuseppina called an avalanche of cards, letters, congratulations, books, and poems poured in continuously from well-wishers across the world. Even so, Verdi was depressed, and without the availability of either psychological or chemical therapy, there seemed to be little he or anyone else could do about it. After having received a very unhappy letter from Verdi, Emanuele Muzio replied, and we quote, "Why can't you just be happy? It makes me feel sad to read about you. You have everything, domestic happiness, health, honors, and money. I hope your letter was just a passing black cloud," unquote. But Verdi's mood was not a passing black cloud. He had reached that age when he saw his great and good friends, Clara Maffei and Operandino Arrivabene among them, begin to die off one by one. And Verdi was also becoming increasingly demanding, if that was at all possible, about how his operas were performed. Much as he moaned and groaned about his operas, they were truly his bambini, his babies, and he came to consider almost any performance that he himself did not oversee as child abuse. He even went so far as to talk about actually withdrawing Otello and forbidding its performance entirely. I know, it sounds a bit crazy, but there you are. If Verdi heard about a bad performance of any of his operas, he got upset. But if he heard about a bad performance of Otello, well, he'd go off the deep end. For example, when Otello was revived at La Scala in 1889, Verdi did not approve of the cast, and he raged to Ricordi, we quote, "Poor Otello, destined this year to experiments by ripped-up throats and the worst provincial screamers," unquote. Perhaps more than anything else, the composition of Otello, which had taken so long and had been such a laborious affair, reminded him just how much he loved to write opera. And as the year 1889 dawned and progressed, the prospects of Verdi ever having the strength to write another opera seemed remote. And then, re-enter Arrigo Boito. Falstaff. As you may recall, Verdi's first operatic commission for La Scala, we're talking way back in 1840, was a comic opera, the disastrous Un Giorno da Regno, King for a Day. Disastrous because it was while composing Un Giorno that Verdi's first wife, Margherita, died fast on the heels of the deaths of his daughter, Virginia, and his son, Icilio. The months during the composition and production of Un Giorno were the worst of Verdi's life. As you recall, his friends and family were genuinely concerned that he would go mad from grief. The first performance of Un Giorno da Regno was an unmitigated disaster, and it turned out to be the only performance of Un Giorno da Regno, which was never heard from again, at least not in Verdi's own lifetime. On top of his grief, the Un Giorno da Regno fiasco almost finished Verdi off, and he swore he would never compose again. Of course, he did compose again, though Verdi never entirely recovered from that time, not that any of us would, and he never wrote another comic opera. Indeed, a strong case can be made for describing Verdi's preference for dark, nasty, melodramatic operatic stories as a necessary emotional outlet for his own ongoing grief and existential pain. Now, almost 50 years later, Verdi talked about writing another comic opera. And one of the people he talked about it with was Arrigo Boito. During the summer of 1889, roughly 2.5 years after the premiere of Otello, Verdi casually mentioned to Boito that Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor would make a wonderful comic opera, and that the character of Sir John Falstaff was a particularly good comic study. Well, that was all Boito needed to hear. Within just a few days, Boito delivered a draft scenario entitled Falstaff, and Verdi loved it. On July 7th, 1889, the nearly 76-year-old Verdi wrote Boito and expressed both his delight and his misgivings about getting involved in yet another opera project. We quote that letter. Benissimo, benissimo. No one could have done the scenario better than you. However, in sketching Falstaff, did you consider the large number of years in my age? I know perfectly well that you will answer me by exaggerating the state of my health, saying that it is good, excellent, and robust. And that is true. All the same, you will agree with me that I could be accused of great rashness in taking on such a job. And what if I were not able to hold up under the work? And what if I were not to finish the music? Then you would have wasted so much time and effort for nothing. I would not want that for all the gold in the world, unquote. And that's the truth. Verdi adored Boito and didn't want to waste Boito's time. But having expressed his misgiving and actually thought about composing again, we are told that Verdi's depression lifted almost instantly and was replaced with genuine euphoria. On July 10th, 3 days after having written the just-quoted letter, Verdi again wrote Boito, quote, "What a joy to be able to say to the audience, we are here again, come and see us. Amen, so be it. So let's do Falstaff. For now, let's not think of the obstacles of age, of illness. I also want to keep the deepest secrecy, a word that I underlined 3 times to tell you that no one must know anything about it. Of course, Peppina knew about it before we did, I think. But don't worry, she will keep the secret. When women have this trait, they have more of it than we men do. Anyway, if you are in the mood, then start to write," unquote. As it turns out, they were both in the mood to write, and compared to the on-again, off-again, 8-year marathon that was the creation of Otello, Falstaff came about somewhat more quickly, though at 4 years from start to finish, no one would accuse Verdi and Boito of rushing. For his part, Boito outdid himself with the libretto, although, as with Otello, he was awed and frankly terrified by the task of editing, altering, and adapting a play by the man, by Shakespeare, for the Italian opera stage. Early in the process, Boito wrote of his trepidation, and his words stand as an object lesson for anyone aspiring to write a libretto. We quote Boito. "I should like, as one sprinkles sugar on a tart, to sprinkle the whole comedy with joyful love," and Boito refers here to the relationship between Anne and Fenton, the young lovers whom we will meet in due time. "During the first few days of writing the libretto, I was in despair. To sketch the characters, to weave the plot, to extract all the juice from the enormous Shakespearean orange without letting the useless pulp slip into the little glass, to write with color and clarity and brevity, to delineate the musical plane of the scene so that there results an organic unity, to make the joyous comedy live from beginning to end, to make it live with a natural and communicative gaiety is difficult, difficult, difficult. And yet it must seem simple, simple, simple," unquote. Parenthetically, we should add that Boito's libretto for Falstaff is undoubtedly his finest work and among the very greatest libretti ever written. The English writer Francis Toy committed what was, for many of his English brethren, an unpardonable blasphemy when he went so far as to write that, and we quote, "I would venture to assert that on the whole, Boito's Falstaff is a better comedy than Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor. The action is less diffuse, the intrigue more tidy and concentrated," unquote. Once word inevitably got out that Verdi and Boito were working on another opera, Ricordi rather recklessly expressed his wish in a letter to Verdi that they work just a little more quickly. Verdi replied to Ricordi, and in a tone actually quite civil for him, he explained that at almost 78 years of age, he simply couldn't write as fast as he once did. We quote Verdi. When I was young, I could stay at the desk for 10 or even 12 hours, even when I was slightly ill, working steadily. More than once, I sat down at work at 4 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon with nothing more than coffee in my stomach, working right through without a break. Now I cannot. Then I was in command of my body and time. Alas, now I am not. Unquote. Yes, there were moments during Falstaff's composition that Verdi believed he was unequal to the task, moments when he was convinced that he simply wouldn't be able to finish what he had begun. Sometimes weeks, even months, went by without Verdi writing a single note. On returning to St. Agata in the spring of 1891, after such a period of compositional poverty, Verdi told Giuseppina, quote, Falstaff is pale and wan. Let's hope we can find some good capon to fill his paunch again. And then referring to himself, Verdi continued, everything depends on the doctor. Who knows? Who knows? Unquote. Early on, Verdi and Boito began referring to the opera and its title character as Big Belly. In June of 1891, Verdi got back on track and wrote a worried Boito that he was getting back into the compositional saddle. We quote Verdi, the Big Belly is back on the road to madness. I admit, there are some days when he does not move. He sleeps and is in bad humor. At other times, he shouts, runs, jumps, and tears the place apart. I let him act up a bit, but if he goes on like this, I will have to put him in a muzzle and a straitjacket. Unquote. Well, Boito was thrilled. He was overjoyed to hear that Big Belly was up and around and wreaking as much havoc as he chose to wreak. He wrote to Verdi in reply, and we quote Boito's letter. Great! Let him do it! Let him run! He will smash all the glass and furniture in your room. It doesn't matter! You will buy more. He will break up the piano! It doesn't matter! You will buy another one. Let everything be wrecked so long as the opera gets done. Hurrah! Hit him! Hit him! Hit him! Hit him! What pandemonium! But it is pandemonium that is as bright as the sun and as crazy as a madhouse. Hurrah! Unquote. A marvelous letter, and a letter that betrays the sense of energy and joy that both Boito and Verdi felt in the creation of Falstaff. To think that Verdi waited this long in his life to write a comic opera and to show us his extraordinary comic chops in the process. A very different emotional state, we think, exists when one is writing a comedy than when one is writing such a tragedy as Otello. And certainly the spirit of Falstaff, both the person and the story, infused Verdi and Boito with a sense of joyful optimism and energy that we can only, be jealous of and envy them. On that note, lots more of Falstaff when we return. Thank you.